Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello, James. And our Total Film contributor, Ashanti Omka. Hi, Ashanti.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we're going to be getting meta with Nicolas Cage in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. We'll be appraising festival hit Happening and feeling musical with the new Ennio Morricone documentary. But before we get onto those guys, we should probably discuss Cannes. The film festival is back in full force this year. We've got a lineup. James, you're going. What can we expect from this year? What are we going to get when we're down on the Croisette?
It's very Cannes, basically. It's a very classic Cannes lineup. You've got four former Palme d'Or winners in competition. Ruben Östlund with his new film Triangle of Sadness. The Dardennes, as ever, they've always got to be there. They're back with Torian Lakita, it's called. You've got Hirokazu Koreeda, the Japanese director who won for Shoplifters. He's back with his new one, Broker, which is a very unusual sounding film about boxes that are left for parents to put unwanted children in, which is a very strange idea. And then you've got the Romanian director, Christian Mungi, for his new one, RMN. And there's not a lot known about that. But the one I'm most excited about is David Cronenberg's Crimes of the Future. I mean, Everyone thought it was going to be a new David Lynch. Instead, we've got a new David Cronenberg. I'm just as happy with that, basically.
Which has got all the body horror and weirdness going on. We've seen the trailer with the, you know, the classic Christopher Nolan noise in it, which suggests quality. And then people having weird operations and Kristen Stewart's in it. Looks very intriguing, doesn't it? But you're missing out another film. There is a film that's not very Cannes. That is premiering at Cannes, James, that involves fighter pilots.
I wonder what that could be. Top Gun Maverick.
Top Gun!
With a massive Tom Cruise. I think they're doing a big tribute to him. He's doing a big onstage Q&A, which is, you don't get many chances to see that. So that's going to be a real hot ticket. So yes. And also Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. I mean, that is... Baz has been there a couple of times before. Last time, I think, with Great Gatsby, I think, last time, and previously Moulin Rouge. So, yeah, Baz always brings the glitz. And then with the cruiser on the red carpet, I mean, yeah, it's Cannes back in full effect, it feels.
Yes. Looking forward to what we might expect, Ashanti. Do you enjoy what comes out of Cannes?
Well, this time we have Idris Elba and Tilda Swinton. And, you know, I love both of them. 3,000 Years of Longing. And I'm super hyped for that. I have to say, there are not as many women at Cannes this year as I was hoping. They are not busting those diversity goals on that side of things. On the other hand, though, they have got some directors like Saeed Rustai and Tariq Saleh coming into the mix. So they're busting diversity on one side of things and not on the other. So in terms of gender bias or gender, they haven't quite hit the nail on the head, but happy to see that Claire Denis coming back in and Kelly. How do you pronounce it? Reichardt? Is that right?
Reichardt.
Yeah. That's it. So I'm quite happy that they're both in, not happy that other women aren't, but hey, it's all good.
But it's all back on. I mean, we're back on. We're probably going to have parties on yachts, James, parties at villas, you know, like the queuing with your different coloured passes, you know, all of this shenanigans that we loathe about Cannes, but also love.
Well, last year they did introduced booking your tickets online, which I think they're continuing this year. So there'll be that, the idea being that there'll be less queuing. Obviously, they did it originally to be COVID safe. So that's something that will continue. So that kind of works a little bit better. At least you know once you're heading to the cinema, you've got a ticket and you're going to get in. So that's a little bit of a
didn't
advantage.
Always used to happen. Sometimes you could get right to that door and there would be non monsieur, non madame.
In that French accent, exactly. Perfect.
And you'd be like, oh, and you're sunburnt, your feet hurt, you're thirsty and you've got nowhere and you have to go back to your quite rubbish accommodation and write something else.
So I have never been to Cannes. I've just got to put it out there. Never. I've actually not been at all. So I've never experienced these joys you described, James.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to try it next year then.
Yes. Maybe. I mean, it's one of those festivals that is just so difficult and tricky and annoying, but it's also, you know, you feel great fun doing it as well, because you're all in it together, sort of running around this town, trying to see films, trying to get into films, trying to get on yachts, because of course, why would you not want to go to a party on a yacht? Trying to find a cheap lunch, which is quite difficult in the French Riviera, trying to avoid the dog poo. That's the other thing. Loads of dog poo in Cannes. Feels like everyone's got a very tiny dog. Don't clean it up. It's just a sort of strange microcosm, isn't it, for 2 weeks whilst that festival's on. And it's crazy in that town. And then everyone goes away and just left to the ladies in the caftans walking the tiny dogs, goes back to normal. It'll be a good one, though, if the cruise is there this year. So, James, you're off, aren't you?
I am indeed.
You're going to be reporting for Total Film. And our lovely Jordan Farley is also going, as is Neil Smith. So do look online on Games Radar for our updates from the festival. Right, shall we look at what we can watch this week? And let's kick it off with this. It's time to get in the cage with this.
Welcome to Mallorca, Mr. Cage.
The guy that owns this house, what's his name?
Javi.
Is Javi going to want me to...
I am Javi.
Nick Cage. God, this place is stunning.
What is your favorite movie?
That's one of those questions that's impossible to answer. You can't just limit it to one. Imagine me and
you. This is The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, starring one Nicolas Cage. James, tell us a bit about this.
This is, as the poster says, Nicolas Cage is Nick Cage, which I really like, actually. So he is playing himself, or a version of himself. He's at the beginning, not in the best point of his career, and it's really, on some level, echoing his actual career that, you know, once upon a time, he was being paid $20 million to do things like The Rock and Armageddon, and now he's making smaller films, he's working too much, he's a little bit down in his career. His agent, played by Neil Patrick Harris, isn't really helping very much, and offers him a chance to earn $1 million to fly to Spain to sort of go and present himself at a sort of a super fan's birthday. And as he owes $600,000 for a sort of rather expensive hotel room that he's been staying in for the last few weeks, he decides to go. He's also sort of somewhat estranged from his teenage daughter, played by Liddy Sheen. He's also got an ex-wife now, played by Sharon Horgan. And he turns up in Spain, and it turns out that the CIA are kind of watching this guy. This guy's called Javi, played by Pedro Pascal, obviously from The Mandalorian. Javi has written a script that he's desperate for Nick Cage to be in. He is an actual super Nick Cage fan. There's a wonderful moment later on when you realize how much of a fan he is.
Yes.
But the CIA sort of grab Cage and say, you've got to sort of spy on Javi, basically. And it kind of goes on from there. I won't say too much more. There's a lot of twists and turns along the way. But yeah, you get Nick as Nick. What more do you want?
I mean, you know, this man has had a huge career, and all the jokes are made about that back catalogue. Does it work? Is it so up its own sort of meta universe that it's not really working, or is it funny?
I did find it funny to start with. The first third really does set up Cage brilliantly. Very early on, he's having a conversation with the director, played by David Gordon Green. They don't even acknowledge that it's David Gordon Green, even if it's supposed to be. He's sort of an unnamed character. And of course, Green directed him in Joe a few years ago. So already you're on this kind of meta trip. It gets more, there are more and more references to sort of older Cage movies as we go along. All of that stuff I absolutely loved. As the film goes on, it becomes more of a kind of buddy action comedy with the Javi character. I was less interested in that as a plot. The obvious comparison really is Adaptation, yes, the Spike Jonze film, where Cage played Charlie Kaufman and Charlie Kaufman, who obviously scripted Adaptation, and also played Kaufman's fictional twin. So again, Cage has got experience in diving into this kind of meta universe. But that film was more of an art house film. This is much more of a kind of accessible action comedy, if you like that kind of thing. I was more on the Adaptation trip myself, but this is a fun night out. And if you're a Cage fan, you will dig all the references. And there are, I'd love to go back through the film again to literally dig out hundreds and hundreds of Cage references in that movie.
I think you might be being a bit of a snob, James. I only like my art house meta, Nick Cage. Yeah. What did you think, Ashanti? Because I flipping love this.
I absolutely loved it. I laughed all the way through. I had seen Ike, Baron Holtz. He was in the Mindy Project. And yes. I had actually loved this guy. He's so funny. And him with Tiffany Haddish coming together. These little bits where Neil Patrick Harris pops in. I absolutely love the guy. And what can I say? Pedro Pascal is in it. And they've done this campaign online, which has completely captured my heart, including one with a Mandalorian reference to it, which is really good. So you can watch that if you check out Focus Features and just see the sort of campaign they ran around this film. And I kind of went in not expecting it to be this kind of logical film or any of that. I just went in thinking, this is going to be super fun. And it really was. I just loved the fact that there was a lot of self-deprecating humor. Nicolas Cage was very loud as usual. I had to kind of block one of my ears a lot of the time because he, you know, a lot of shouting going on. But you know,
so you would expect. That's what you want from him, isn't it?
Exactly. This is it. And I should have taken earplugs, I thought. But I didn't, because there are some points where I've got kind of ENT issues and I was feeling it. I was really feeling it. The only thing I would say about this film that I felt that there was a, and this, I shouldn't have been surprised at all. This is a Nick Cage movie, but I felt that the female characters didn't get enough of the innings. They had all of the talent and they weren't given enough of that screen time. I mean, I think Nicolas Cage was in every scene in this film.
Twice, because he has his younger self who he's acting, who's been uncanny valid to a younger version of himself, talking to himself. I mean, this is so like, you know, snake eating itself type thing. You know, you've got references to Cage as younger. He's talking to himself as a younger person. Then there's him making his own jokes about the bees when he's talking about a belt buckle. You know, like there's so many different little nudges and moments. And, you know, even sort of there's John Woo moments in there that sort of call back, you know, Face Off. There's just so many different things in here. So
You've forgotten the best bit that where they name their top three films, Javi and Nicolas Cage.
Yes.
And they sit down and go through their top three. I don't think we should reveal the top three.
We should reveal because
it's so juicy, but
yeah, and Nick Cage's reaction to watching one of Javi's choices is an absolute belter of a laugh. As you say, James, there's this point when they go into a Nick Cage sort of point where we see a lot of paraphernalia, shall we say, that's very amusing as well. I mean, I loved Prisoners of the Ghostland where Cage was just like, this is what I do. I understand my sort of role in the world. I understand how people view me. I understand my persona. I understand what I am. He just seems to have a really good handle on his image and who he actually is, not losing track of that and being able to perform it. So he does that to the nth degree here. And, you know, like, as you say, this scene with Green in Chateau Marmont, where he does a line reading for him that's just appalling, but totally Nicolas Cage, and the horror on Green's face. I loved all of this inside baseball kind of movie stuff, the stuff inside Chateau Marmont, the stuff inside Sunset Tower, the agent, the stupid sort of health retreat they go on, all of it. I loved it. But yes, I agree with you, Ashanti. The female characters were sort of left behind in the dust. You know, we had this great CIA operative who was helping him out, who then literally disappeared, never to be seen of, never spoken of again. And she is saving his life in a number of occasions and just not heard of again. And then, you know, obviously Sharon Horgan, who is one of my neighbours, I should say, is...
You should have got her on.
I know. Should have popped round. Sharon, come round with a cup of tea.
She was fabulous. In those few moments we saw her, she was just utterly fabulous.
But didn't you think they kind of missed the trick of a sort of meta knowing thing of not casting Kate Beckinsale, who is the mother of Lily Sheen, and sort of having that sort of thing going on? Not that Sharon isn't great, because she's absolutely fabulous, but I sort of kind of thought it would have been funny had it been Kate Beckinsale's mother, who is then replaced in a film by another actress.
Or you could have gone and cast Patricia Arquette and gone really meta, basically.
Yes. You know, like, you could have gone even more so. But as it is, there's quite a lot to get out of this. And as you say, I'm sure if you watch this numerous times, you'd get more and more little nods and references. And I absolutely loved Pedro Pascal in this, but I also loved, really enjoyed him in The Bubble, where we've recently seen him also lampooning Hollywood and being a bit silly. So I want to see more of him doing comedy. I think he's great at it.
No, he's is very, very good.
Agreed. And I just want to shout out the cinematographer, Nigel Bluck, who just gave us the vistas we really need right now.
Holiday vistas. Holiday
vistas, exactly.
Oh, as long as you can go and stay in Javi's compound. What is it? Is it an olive oil business he has, I think?
Supposedly, yes.
Supposedly, yeah.
Yes.
Lots, lots of things to do with green leaves.
Yes. And, you know, beautiful views. Mallorca looks gorgeous. I'm totally into that. I would be very happy to go for £1 million. But I have to say, I thought £1 million was a little underwhelming for Nicolas Cage to actually want to go. I think it should have been about three to make him really want to do it. Because a million doesn't buy you much in the Sunset Tower, does it really, if you're staying there? But yeah, I think it's a really funny film. And I think it's a funny film that you could enjoy just as a buddy action comedy without knowing anything else. Or you could really enjoy it as a Cage fan, or really just enjoy it as a movie fan who really enjoys sort of the inside track of making movies. There's sort of elements of The Player and all sorts going on here. So yeah, I flipping loved it. So James, I'm just going to say, I think you're a bit of a grump.
Well, I think first of all, I should add, Adaptation, I think, is one of the great films of the 21st century.
Agreed.
And I'm not saying this is a bad film in any way. And I love what they do with Cage. I just am a huge fan of that film. And it's in a weird sort of way, I think both films, as you said, the sort of snake starts eating itself. And I feel like this film, each act to some degree echoes a part of Cage's career, because the first act is kind of more character driven, which I guess is more of the early part of his career. Then it becomes more action driven, which was very much the middle part of Cage's career. And then it just goes kind of completely crazy, which is very much the Mandy Pig era of Cage's career. So it's quite cleverly structured as a film. And I did laugh kind of frequently, just sort of more towards the end. As you said, certain characters drop out. I just think structurally it could have been a bit tighter. You know, the actual concept of it is very sound indeed.
Indeed. Okay, that is The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Go and have a good time. Now, we do have a top three movies in the film, so I think we probably should give praise to Cage here. And tell us, what are your top three Nicolas Cage movies? James?
Well, I've already given the first one away. Adaptation is my number one. Number two, Face Off. Number three, Wild at Heart.
Ashanti?
I would go for Lord of War. Mm. I'd go for Moonstruck, because I didn't quite think Cage would do romance like he did. And Con Air.
Con Air, classic. I'm going to go Leaving Las Vegas, Raising Arizona, and The Rock. I love
it. There you go. That's nine different films we've managed to choose as well.
I do have a sort of love of Bad Lieutenant as well, I have to say. I think I enjoy what they did with that, and I actually prefer it to the original one. So there we go. Okay, so from Spain to France now. Let's go with this.
Faites quelque chose. Vous ne pouvez pas me demander ça. Toute personne qui vous aiderait risque de finir en prison et vous avec.
On dirait que tu as une maladie. Nous, on sait ce que tu fais. Tu étais dehors hier soir.
Mais qu'est-ce que t'as fait?
Aidez-moi, il faut trouver quelqu'un.
Ça ne nous regarde pas.
T'es enfant?
Tu veux finir en prison avec elle?
Okay, so this is happening. Ashanti, what is happening here?
What is happening indeed? I have to say, I went into this with a very different mindset from how I felt coming out of this. Because in this country, we take getting pregnant, choosing to have a child, you know, we take it for granted, you know, you have the choice. And it's great for women in the UK. And you forget that in a country as close as France, you could just get there in 2.5 hours on a Eurostar. And that this is obviously set in 1963. That wasn't the case at all. You get pregnant and be having an abortion is something that was unthinkable in that era. I'm not really sure if that law has changed very much in France even now. But this film examines this wonderful, you know, wonderful young woman, Anna Maria Bartolome. She is very talented. She's studying. Her final exams are yet to come. And, you know, she's not doing much stuff socially, but she's kind of met this guy. They've been going out. They've been having sex. And she falls pregnant. And she has to kind of deal with the fact that it's a huge taboo to fall pregnant without kind of being married, et cetera, et cetera. And also, you know, the fact that if she went in for an abortion, she could get put in jail. So this is a pretty stark kind of premise. And they actually give out a film that is so, again, very, very stark, very painful to watch in many places. Audrey Diwan has done a brilliant job. I have to give her props for bringing out this kind of story in such a detailed way. So she's a Lebanese film director. She's very much into equality between men and women in the film industry. She won the Golden Lion for this at the Venice Film Festival. And this film really is very affecting to watch. And certainly I felt the pain of this girl. This was what I liked about the film so much, was the fact that you completely immerse yourself into this story and you come out thinking, wow, the liberties we have in England are not the liberties a lot of people have and had around the world, and how far feminism has come for us, certainly over here in the UK. And, you know, kind of makes you think about the wider world and what women have to go through.
Indeed. It's been really well received by critics and it's very unflinching, isn't it? There's some scenes that I had to watch through my fingers, but not in a sort of overly provocative or sensationalist way, just very sort of clear-eyed and also from a sort of a female viewpoint. Yes, I mean, astonishing. James, what did you think of it? How did it affect you?
Yeah, I mean, echoing what both of you said, I mean, it's a very measured piece of work, kind of very classical in a way, and very simple as a story. It's very easy to follow. I mean, this young girl, this young student, she's kind of like a little soldier in a way. She just keeps going forward on this mission. She's on her own. She can't tell anybody really that she's pregnant. She's got no support. And, you know, there's a couple of sort of awful scenes early on where she kind of speaks to the doctors, one of whom is even quite sympathetic, but just can barely breathe the word abortion because it's obviously at this point in France, it's illegal. Any medic that would help her would be in trouble. I mean, they're tied up in sort of legal knots as well. Yeah. And yet she knows what she wants. She knows she can't cope with a child. And, you know, she's a student. She wants to be a teacher at this point early on in the narrative. And she just sort of works her way through the system, let's say, or rather the non-system, to try and find out how on earth she could, you know, terminate this pregnancy. I mean, I interviewed Audrey and Anna Maria for this, and they talked about, we mentioned the Dardennes earlier, who, as we said, were coming back to Cannes this year. Their film in 1999 that won the Palme d'Or, Rosetta, which was sort of about a young girl who's kind of supporting her alcoholic mother, and similarly is kind of like this sort of little soldier who just doesn't give up. That was a big influence on them making this film. And you can completely see it when you watch it, if you've seen Rosetta. Yeah, as I said, a very measured piece of work. Very well done. Never, as you said, Jane, never sort of overdone, never kind of extreme, but has its moments that, like you said, you'll be watching through your fingers.
Mm. Yes. And the performance here from this actress is amazing as well. I think props to her, that she's quite extraordinary the way she portrays this. It's not hysterical. She's very determined, as you say, this little soldier. But I just think she's really portraying a female experience here. The frustration, the fact that these doctors are all sort of telling her to just accept that she has no control over her body, or even actually sort of blindsiding her with, you know, things that they've done that are against her will. It's a really interesting, really thought-provoking film. It won't be for everybody, will it?
No.
It's a tough watch. It's a really tough watch. You know, I was still just thinking about it now. I have to say that I was totally, totally moved, but also very, very disturbed. And it just reminded me that the laws around the world are really harsh on women, and that women's rights, you know, are still in a very regressive place. And this film, still in 2022, we're watching it and we're saying, actually, all over the world, women are struggling with this very subject.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so if you fancy Happening, it's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. And as always, it's somebody we've talked about already. And I'm going to do this in the style of a tiny child. Let me know if you know what this is.
Well, I'm one of those fortunate people who like my job, sir. Got my first chemistry set when I was 7. Blew my eyebrows off. We never saw the cat again. Been into it ever since.
Well, given we basically talked about Anna Maria Bartolome and Nicolas Cage, I'm fairly sure it's going to be Nicolas Cage. Are we talking Cage, action era Cage here?
Think about my top 3 films.
Ah,
do you know Ashanti?
Is it The Rock?
It is The Rock. And obviously it sounds nothing like a small child.
You threw us off.
That's the point of it. That's the game. Okay, it sounds like this.
Well, I'm one of those fortunate people who like my job, sir. Got my first chemistry set when I was 7, blew my eyebrows off. We never saw the cat again. Been into it ever since.
Okay, let's move on. It's time to celebrate the maestro with this.
Rigore disse, non so non mette applauso de banda su tutto.
Was very new at the time, and still today.
He opens up the visuals.
You hear his music, you know it is Ennio.
Can't be anybody else.
It's not just popular, it's an anthem.
We always come out to that, and we always leave to that. Deep, deep, deep emotion.
So this is Ennio. And who is Ennio, James?
This is, of course, the legendary Ennio Morricone, the Italian composer, maestro of over 500 scores, from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly to The Mission to The Hateful Eight. And this is a documentary about his life and his work. He died, of course, in July 2020 when he was 91. But this was really, or at least a significant portion of it, was made before he died, because there's a lot of interviews in the film with him. The director is Giuseppe Tornatore, and he's the one of the perfect directors to make this film, because Morricone scored Cinema Paradiso that Tornatore directed. He also did The Legend of 1900 and Milena, again, directed by Tornatore. So, he, you know, they collaborated a great deal across the sort of late 80s and 90s. And it's just a wonderful reminder of how incredible Morricone's music is. It's a real talking heads documentary. You've got just about everyone from Hollywood you would want to hear from: Quentin Tarantino, Clint Eastwood, Oliver Stone, the list goes on and on. It's a long film, but you would expect that from somebody who's got over 500 scores. And I have to say, what I really liked about it is, whatever your favorite score is, unless it's something incredibly obscure, they seem to just hit the bullet points here. You're sitting there waiting for, I don't know, a segment on Once Upon a Time in America, and there it comes, basically. All of my favourite scores were sort of touched upon, and I'm sure most people would feel the same.
Yes. I mean, what did you think, Ashanti? Are you a sort of fan of Morricone, or did this open your eyes?
Totally. I've always loved his music. And also, I didn't know very much about him. This was really illuminating to see the different facets of this man, who he wanted to be a doctor. This is just the opposite of anything I know about musicians, because every musician I know wanted to become a musician and their parents wanted them to become a doctor. So in a completely different twist, here's a man who wanted to become a doctor. His dad sent him to study the trumpet and said, this is what I want you to do. His mother said to him, you know, write nice melodies. That's what will make you popular. And he had a wife, this very calm woman, Maria Travia, who was kind of not just his soulmate, but also the woman who was his sounding board. So he went to her. And I love the fact that all the directors heard what she had given a tick mark to and said, yeah, you can play this to them. And this man, wow. I mean, as a child, I'd seen The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, maybe not the film I should have watched as a child, but that theme kind of stayed with me through life. And just to see him, you know, this is a man who wanted to quit almost every 10 years. He talks about that. And I found that really interesting that he went on all the way to his 90s, but he never wanted to become a musician and he wanted to quit every decade. So it's really interesting to see how he turned out to be this huge, huge, huge legend. And this film is beautiful. It is long, I think over 2.5 hours, I think 2 hours and 37 minutes. It's a long, long watch, but it is worth every minute. You just feel so inspired to see him talking about music. He's such an intellectual with music. So those bits, and for me, coming from a musical background, I was totally there for it. I can highly recommend it as a film to watch.
Yeah, and also it's got loads of great talking heads who are really talking about the impact that he had and like how his score contributes to a film, how it layers a film. You know, you've got people from Quentin Tarantino to Bruce Springsteen talking about the power of Morricone's music. So, you know, you don't have to be musical to understand this. There's loads of entry points for this, I found. And as you say, I think it is long. But when you've made as much music as this guy, you know, how do you shorten it? How do you cut some things out and not others? I mean, and there's loads of soundtracks in there that I'd sort of forgotten that he did. Mm. I think it's a really fascinating insight into, you know, a part of the industry that, you know, the Oscar ceremony is trying to forget that anything other than acting awards or acting genius happens. It's great to celebrate people who contribute to film in such a huge way that being wiped out of Oscar history on the telecast.
Yeah, I'd be disappointed if this film was shorter. I mean, you know, some long films are not always easy, but yeah, this is, as you say, he's got so many scores. It needs this amount, this breadth that the film really delivers. I'd also say, if you are planning to watch it, please, please go and see it at the cinema. With good sound, obviously, because it would play fine at home in terms of the visuals, but unless you've got some amazing setup at home, you really need to immerse yourself in the big screen experience for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that is Ennio, and that is out in cinemas and on demand on Friday. We probably should do as we said, our top three Nick Cage. We probably should say what our favorite Ennio score is. James, what's the one for you?
Well, The Ecstasy of Gold, which is the graveyard sequence in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, which Metallica always come out to as well, which I think is featured in the film, if I remember. Uh-huh. That would be my number one. Once Upon a Time in America, number two. Number three, let's say The Mission.
Oh, The Mission. A joy. A shanty.
I'm just going to go for Cinema Paradiso and that's it. I'm not even picking a top three. I just feel like it's very hard for somebody to top a score like that, because the way he immerses you into the movie is not just, it's never jarring. It's always part of the narrative. You just feel that score kind of envelope the air around you while you're watching this beautiful film. And, you know, it's not surprising that it won the BAFTA award. Interestingly, his second son, Andrea Morricone, was the co-composer of that with him. And I just love the fact that, you know, yes, you might say, oh, it's nepotism, but I just love the fact that the talent that ran in the family just brought us this epic score.
Mm, yes. I'm going to go for The Untouchables. You know, I have a problem with Kevin Costner in as much as I love him deeply. So
that's
I have
not a problem.
you know, like The Untouchables is an amazing film and I love the score and it's a different, I feel like it's quite different from Morricone and what we're used to. I mean, obviously he's incredibly diverse in the different types and themes he does. But I really love that one. And obviously The Mission. I mean, that oboe, oh, just it can make me weep just listening to it. So that would be mine. I only have two because I can't choose a third. So many. Okay, so that's it for this week. Not a huge amount out, but what is your film of the week, Ashanti?
Definitely Massive Talent, for sure.
James, what about you?
I'll go for Ennio just because I love listening to, wallowing in his music again.
I would go for Massive Talent as well. I think that's a really good one, a good fun one. Okay, so before we go though, it is time for another listener's question. And this one's a bit miserable. And I'm really sorry to hear this, but I've just had the gastric flu. What's your favourite puking scene in a movie?
What a question.
So James.
There's only one really you can pick, and it is Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. With John Cleese as Mr. Creosote, kind
his
of
Wafer-thin mint.
Exploding in vomit, basically. So I think I'll have to pick that one.
Yes. Ashanti.
As usual, I always seem to have five or six, but this time it's two answers. One is a movie. This is Matrix for me, because people who know me well know I'm a huge fan of Matrix. And, you know, he's kind of taken into the real world and kind of he is released from the cocoon. And there he goes and he pukes, very kind of significant in the movie. So that's one I can pick. And of course, for the TV kind of critic and lover in me, it has to be Baby Yoda, aka Grogu, after eating blue macarons, going and flying with his dad, having a great time and puking, you know, blue. What can I say? Ties in with the Massive Talent and the Massive Talent of Pedro Pascal. Mm-hmm. And when Pedro Pascal says to him, oh boy, and then kind of cleans his mouth, it's just too cute.
Yeah, yes, that's a good one. I would probably have to go for Bridesmaids. Well, it comes out both ends, as they say, not confident which end. And they're, you know, Melissa McCarthy's sitting in the sink and then someone is puking in the bowl and someone else pukes on their hair because there's just nowhere else to go. That is a cracker, just so funny. But also Stand By Me for a myriad of vomiting when Lardass glugs the castor oil, eats a pie, and then has everybody in the audience puking. That is cracking sick up. So those are mine. That is all that's left for this week. Shall we say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, James.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Next week, we'll be taking a well-earned break and having a little holiday. Not altogether, mind, but we will not be here next week. But do join us the week after when we'll have more reviews of the films that matter.
What is that? What is that? What is it? Oh, no, not the beast! Not the beast! Ah! Oh, my God!